Most rural Alaskans pay 3 to 5 times more for their electric bill than residents in Anchorage. And most villages are relying on deteriorating diesel electric systems that cost a lot to operate and maintain. I'm Annie Feit. A new report funded by the Department of Energy focuses on sustainable energy solutions for the 200 communities in rural Alaska. And that's our topic today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
When it comes to electricity, rural Alaska is a vast landscape dotted with microgrids serving small communities. Some of these systems are extremely innovative, but many are making do with older diesel generators, and a few are barely hanging on. So what's the solution? Joining me today is the author of a new report that tries to answer that question. It's called Sustainable Energy Solutions for Rural Alaska, and Peter Larson is one of the report authors and a research scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Hello, Peter.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. And Dave Messier is also with us. He's the Rural Energy Coordinator for Tanana Chiefs Conference. He helped gather information for the report and works on these issues every day. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Annie. Thanks.
And we want to hear from you, too. How much do you pay for electricity? Do you have an idea that could reduce that rate? Give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, please dial 550-8422. And you can always reach us on email. That is talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Peter, I want to start with you. You traveled to 34 communities for this report, and really they were spread across the state to do research. Can you describe why you wanted to visit so many communities and how you went about that process?
Yeah, I think our Department of Energy program officer, a gentleman named Givi Kokonoski, he really felt that it was important to get an outside perspective on what was happening in rural Alaska. And he also felt that it was extremely important to visit a lot of communities. You can't just visit one community and try to capture what's happening for a state that, you know, is the size of Alaska, you know, 250 million plus acres. And so the directions we got from the Department of Energy were really come up with an impartial perspective on what's happening across rural Alaska. And to do that, you know, you're going to need to travel to a lot of communities. And so we did spend a lot of time on the road.
And Dave, at what point did you join in?
Sure, I joined in for the interior villages that were on their scheduled trip. So they told me they wanted to see a variety of different utility structures and kind of levels of efficiency. And so we took them up to Fort Yukon, which is a corporation-owned utility. We took them up to Venus High and Arctic Village, which are both tribal government-run utilities. And then we took them out to Central and Circle, which are on the road system and are both privately owned utilities. So I was on them for those five villages.
And I don't know who wants to answer this question first, but just what questions did you ask when you visited these places?
So, yeah, this is Pete. We came up with a number of questions ahead of time that we really wanted to ask almost every member of the utility and the community that we visited. The questions range from what types of, you know, power generation units are, you know, powering this community? Are they diesel generators? Is it wind? Is it a combination of wind and diesel and hydro? We asked questions like that. We asked questions, you know, looking into how often are there power outages here, and how long are the power outages lasting? We asked a lot of questions about, you know, who works for the utility? Do you have a lot of people in the local community that are helping out with management of the utility or maintenance, or are you having to go outside of your community and go to maybe a hub community like Kotzebue or Bethel or even beyond those hub communities into Anchorage and beyond to try to find workers to help manage the system? We also asked a lot of questions about whether energy efficiency was happening in the community. And just other issues that were happening. Was there adequate support from the state? What about the tribal, you know, government? So we asked a lot of those sorts of questions as well.
And what did you learn, and what were the biggest surprises?
I think the biggest surprises for me were that, you know, when you hear about this topic at first glance, it sounds pretty dire. There are a lot of negative things that you hear about, you know, the expensive cost of diesel and the expensive cost of electricity in rural Alaska, and that is very true, and it is very difficult for people living in those communities to have to pay those rates. But the thing that surprised me the most working on this study was that there's a lot of positives, and we met the most amazing collection of people. And Dave can elaborate on this because he works with these people on a day-to-day basis. But in our travels, we just met these amazing people that were like, I don't know if you saw that TV show MacGyver, but were like MacGyvers in every little community. They were able to fix things that, you know, at first glance you wouldn't be able to fix. And somehow, some way, someone figured out a really innovative solution to fix the system. And so that was really encouraging, and that was probably the most surprising and interesting thing that I learned in this project.
And do you have, Dave or Pete, do you have examples of those innovative solutions, the MacGyver-like solutions?
I'll give one example.
Yeah.
I can give one example, and then I'll turn it to Dave because he works a lot more in the field than I do. We visited communities where, the CEO of the utility would describe essentially climbing the pole and changing lines out. And, I live in the lower 48 now. I used to live in Alaska some years ago. It's unheard of to have a CEO of a company climbing a pole and changing a power line and coming up with really innovative fixes that, you know, typically, you have line workers doing this at utilities in the lower 48. But in Alaska, just because there's a shortage of workers, you have people that are able to do a lot of things. And that's one example that we came across.
And Dave, is that your experience as well?
Oh, yeah. For anyone who's spent time in bush communities, they know that you kind of have to work with whatever is available. And so I think out to the gentleman in Circle that's running the utility, and he literally had no experience with utilities when him and his partner bought the utility. And then his partner unfortunately passed away, and so he was reading up on how to do line work from an old Western Union book. There are examples all over the place of these systems. And I will note that it's, you know, some of them are definitely can be described as innovative. Some of them could be described in less flattering terms, and may not be so safe, I guess, as repairs. But, you know, when you're out in a rural community and keeping the lights on, is necessary for operations of the clinic, operations at the water plant, operations at the airport, people to get work done at the city office. I mean, those generators are just so incredibly important in a rural Alaskan community that, yes, you definitely have to be innovative, and you also kind of have to take measures into your own hands to make things work. And so as generators are becoming more and more complicated, I often equate it to new cars that are coming out, the Prius hybrids, new diesel control technologies on F-350s and 250s. The rural generators are getting more complicated, and some of the fixes and repairs that have worked in the past that smaller utility managers and operators have been able to finagle one way or another, I think that's going to be more and more a challenge moving forward both with newer power plants that the state's putting in, but also just as diesel emission control technology gets more advanced, we're already seeing some challenges in that regard. So it's definitely kind of going to be interesting moving forward. And it's important to get a framework as to how these systems were installed, and some villages weren't electrified until the 80s or 90s. They were, you know, just fish camps, and really kind of when the school came in, they were like, wow, well, we need to get electricity. And so for some villages, electricity is really not that old.
And Pete, for the report, I just want to take kind of the broad view here. And for the report, you establish four categories that communities fall into. Can you kind of explain that system and how you categorized them?
Yeah. So one of the things that we discussed as a research team, and I want to note some of the others that really led and spearheaded this project, is an organization called the Regulatory Assistance Project that the organization I work for, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, we hired the Regulatory Assistance Project, also known as RAP, to help with this project. And when I sat down with some of the RAP researchers, and after this point, we'd already seen, you know, probably at least a dozen communities all over the state, and we sort of were struggling with how do you characterize or try to organize all of these different systems, and each one of them is different, and each city and community and pays different amounts for electricity and has different challenges and different opportunities. And what we came up with was this sort of four buckets, as we call it.
Oh, looks like we lost Pete there. Dave, why don't you talk about your area? I mean, in terms of what the actual rates different villages are paying, what is the range there?
Sure. We see everything from a kind of a high-performing standalone community at 18 cents a kilowatt hour after power cost equalization, up to 56 cents a kilowatt hour after power cost equalization. Now, that's PCE is the state subsidies that basically lowers the cost of electricity for the first 500 kilowatt hours on a residential bill. And then there's an equation, 70 kilowatt hours per person per month for community facilities. And so that's kind of the effective rate if you're a fairly efficient home. And it's important to note that most of these rural homes are 1,000, 1,200 square feet. And if you look at how much electricity a rural home uses as compared to a home in Fairbanks or Anchorage, I mean, it's just significantly lower. So that's kind of the range, you know, and I'll note the after power cost equalization, I'm sorry, the before power cost equalization costs, the true costs of electricity range anywhere from a low of probably 60 cents a kilowatt hour to a high of $1, $1.10 per kilowatt hour. And a lot of those, because I, through my position at TANA Chiefs Conference, I, you know, get to work with a lot of these communities and kind of struggle with this question of how can we most cost effectively reduce a cost per kilowatt hour and diesel in rural Alaska. And so one of the things that I was really glad that this study pointed out was some of the challenges just with the operations and maintenance and management of a rural utility system and the opportunities for improvement there, and how just improvements in management, not so much on the equipment. Equipment is something that everybody likes to focus on, because it's something you can do, right? It's got you can install a new generator in a few weeks' time. That's got a clear beginning and an end. Some of the bigger challenges that we see in our rural communities are the standalone utilities that are trying to run an entire utility with a population of, you know, 30 to 120 or 200 people. And so your expertise is kind of limited to those same 200 people. And so you've got the old 80-20 rule, where oftentimes 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work, and that, in, you know, all of a sudden you've got a tribal administrator that has to be an expert in child family services. They've got to respond when there is a medical emergency in the community. And then, by the way, you've also got to manage this rural utility. And so that creates a really big challenge when you're trying to keep those small standalone utilities up to snuff and high performing. And in line with some of the electric cooperatives in the state, which are, which, you know, in the interior for sure, they have the lowest cost per kilowatt hour. And that's, you know, I kind of boil it down to economies of scale. They've got high-paid engineers on staff down in Anchorage that are really pros at what they do. And you contrast that with a small rural Alaskan community that, again, kind of gets its all of its workforce from that smaller pool of 80 to 200 people. And, you know, the cards are definitely stacked against them.
Yeah. And I do want to get into the workforce issue a little bit later. I think we have Pete back on the line. Hi, Pete. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. So you were, let's go back to those categories that you were talking about that for these communities, the big picture view.
Yeah. So we tried to boil down, you know, the 200 plus communities into four categories. And the four categories we boiled the communities down into, in our minds at least, were underperforming systems. So these are systems that have, you know, pretty high staff turnover. They're having a hard time keeping employees. They have high amounts of debt. They're struggling to stay solvent. They either don't keep records at all or keep very limited records on maintenance of their system. And they're basically underperforming in almost every category. So there's a handful of communities, believe it or not, in rural Alaska that fall in the underperforming systems. Then we have a whole group of what we call basic systems where, yeah, they have challenges, but, you know, they're making do with what they have. Yes, there could be plenty of improvements, but these are, you know, systems that they're getting by, at least for now. And then the next categories are kind of the ones that are what we call the shining stars. And so we have advanced diesel systems. These are communities that they, you know, are keeping track of maintenance. They are winning grants. They're winning federal funding awards to keep, you know, improving their system. There's coordination between the utility and the community. And some of the staff have specialized expertise. You may have a mechanic. You may have a line worker. So there's a handful of communities that are advanced diesel systems. And then the real, what we call the innovative systems, are the leading and innovating systems. These are places like St. Paul Island, the Chininik Wind Group, you know, the city of Kodiak, Cordova. These are places that are really functioning at a very, very high level, even by standards in the lower 48. You have really well-trained staff. You have a goal of essentially turning off the diesel generators. And in many cases, they are able to turn off the diesel generators. And so these are the sort of four systems that we tried to boil the 200-plus communities down into. And it helped us think through this report by having, you know, some framework about how to evaluate all these different communities.
Okay, and I want to invite listeners to join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. Or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. We are discussing a new report today called Sustainable Energy Solutions for Rural Alaska. Peter Larson is one of the report authors and our guest, along with Dave Messier from Tanana Chiefs Conference. And you were talking about those innovative systems. Like, describe those. What are we talking about there?
Well, I think there are a couple examples that you could probably read about quite a bit on the internet. But one example is out at St. Paul Island, and I wouldn't say I'm a trained engineer, and I think Dave might be able to speak to this stuff better than I can. But St. Paul Island is using a really innovative combination of wind systems, wind energy, and flywheel technologies, and what we call thermal storage, essentially storing electricity through hot water, storing energy through hot water. And they're able, in certain amounts of certain times of the year and certain durations of time, to actually shut off their diesel generators on an island, which by any standards, whether you're in Alaska or outside of Alaska, that is a huge accomplishment. Another example, which is different than on the generation side, is, you know, a community like Cordova that made a decision a long time ago that they wanted to underground their transmission and distribution lines. And they did that because they were getting hit over and over with storms, and, you know, trees were falling on the lines and causing power outages. Obviously, in a lot of places in Alaska with the permafrost, you can't bury lines very easily, or you probably don't want to. But in some of these coastal communities, and Cordova is one of those, you have a system now that is 100% underground. So there are no trees falling on any of the lines in Cordova anymore. And that's an example of an innovative utility that realized that, you know, a lot of their outages were happening due to storms, and so they made a decision, you know, several decades ago to begin undergrounding all of their lines.
And we have a caller on the line, Sue from Nome. Hello, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I just had kind of a simple question. Back when you were talking about the power cost equalization, because like when I look at my utility bill or my electric bill, you know, I see, $213 for straight electricity. Then I get a $67 PCE credit. But then I have a $140 bill added in for a fuel surcharge. And I just wondered if that is, was that in your calculations as well, the added fuel surcharge? And then does that apply equally around rural Alaska, or is it just really how, you know, how far the barge has to come to deliver fuel to your community? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Okay. Thanks, Sue. And who, Dave, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I can take this one. I've got a decent amount of experience anyway with the power cost equalization program. So I'll note, I guess it's the states, the Alaska Energy Authority, that determines the formula, and it's based on the cost per gallon of diesel and a number of other factors. But PCE, so yes, Sue, your power cost equalization, it does take into account both the cost of power and the cost of fuel delivered to your community, and it's not equal throughout the state. There's a lot of different, there's a lot of varying kind of cause and effect relationships in different communities. The delivered cost of a gallon of diesel really is what determines in large part the amount of power cost equalization that a community will receive. So Nome being on the coast and having a great deal of storage or tankage might have a lower power cost equalization contribution from the state than, say, Arctic Village, which is in my region, which everything must be flown in with a DC-6 and stored on site. So it really, it does vary, and there's a formula, and that's all available on the Alaska Energy Authority website, who are fantastic partners to work with.
Okay, and before Sue's question, we were talking about kind of the more innovative villages. Dave, what are you seeing in your region in terms of systems that are kind of breaking the mold?
Sure. So we just received some funding from the Department of Energy, Indian Energy Office, to do a high penetration solar PV diesel hybrid system up in Hughes. And the Hughes Tribal Council received that grant funding, and they're combining it with some of their own funding. And TCC's cost-sharing a lot of it in terms of my time to help manage the project. But unlike, you know, Kodiak or Cordova or some of the villages along the coast, there's in most of the interior villages, there's no natural, you know, there's no big natural advantages. We're really not known for having high winds in the interior. We don't have a great deal of hydro potential because the rivers, freeze really deep during the winter, and so they're only flowing for 6 to 8 months of the year. And then B, there's much smaller population centers. So Cordova, I believe that's a couple thousand people or under 2,000, over 1,000. But the largest community in the interior is probably Fort Yukon with about 550 people. Most communities are in the 1 to 300 person range. So there's a big challenge there with just economies of scale. And then also the loads. They've got fish processors in a lot of areas on the coast and larger population centers. So where a lot of my interior communities, they definitely struggle with keeping the lights on, and that's partially because of economies of scale and stretched resources. But in terms of renewables, we're trying to do more with diesel efficiency. That's always the number one underlying goal, and we're hoping to receive some assistance there with operations and maintenance from the Denali Commission, and the Alaska Energy Authority, again, has been a fantastic partner to work with, both installing new power plants and providing training out for our interior villages. But in terms of renewable systems, time and time again, solar PV is kind of one of the technologies that is widely available. It's commercially available technology. Solar PV is installed on all seven continents. You know, when Pete's phoning in on his cell phone, it's beaming off a satellite that's powered by solar PV cells. So the technology is there. Oh, the costs have come down substantially, and really it's the integration piece that we're kind of missing. And we get a lot of feedback and a lot of kind of critiques. Well, solar isn't available for parts of the Alaskan year. Well, no, it's not available, but you know what? When you're up in Arctic Village or Hughes and all your fuel is flown in by DC-6s, which, by the way, stopped being manufactured sometime in the late 50s, we're kind of at a point where we're going to take an option that's less than optimal if it helps diversify us off of 100% diesel, which is what most communities are.
And when the sun is shining, does the fact that it's shining for most of the night help?
It definitely does, and it really depends on the type of array that you've got and what it's facing. But for most of the summer, I mean, we see really good solar PV production from really starting in late February, early March, all the way out till the end of October. You get really solid solar PV production. So if you orient your panels kind of due south and as storage, energy storage is developing and the costs are coming down, we might not be tracking the sun for the entire time, but we'll definitely be trying to harness the energy during the day and hopefully be able to use it during parts of the evening and maximize the amount of hours that we're turning the diesel generators off in future systems. That's kind of the goal. A lot of people like to talk about systems where you can store energy during the summer and use it during the winter, and unfortunately we're just not there yet, at least not in a small Alaskan village scale. One day that's definitely the goal, but right now if we could turn it off overnight, that'd be a heck of a big step in the right direction.
And Dave, can you talk about what is at stake for these villages? I mean, how much does the price of electricity matter just in terms of how the village functions and that type of thing?
Sure. It's one of many factors that what we've seen in the interior, at least, is a really population decline. And I'm not blaming it solely on the cost of electricity, but it's one of many contributing factors that I think is driving people out of rural Alaska and into urban Alaska. And, you know, obviously that's going to put more of a strain on urban infrastructure. But rural communities are, you know, when you're paying, I mean, in some villages, Koyukuk, I'll take for example, they're at about 56 cents a kilowatt hour after power cost equalization. So here in Fairbanks, we're actually fairly low in the rail belt right now. I think we're at 18 cents a kilowatt hour. Thank you, GVA. Mm-hmm. But out in Koyukuk, you're paying 2-3 times that for an electric bill. So if you're getting monthly bills that you have to pay that are, you know, 2-3 times what you'd be paying in Fairbanks, all of that starts to add up. And especially as a lot of our elders get older and the cost, you know, it's kind of a trade-off between, you know, they're getting towards a point where it's a little bit too burdensome to go out into the woods and cut down their own firewood. There's definitely still a ton of that happens in the interior. But, you know, as people age, they start to rely a little bit more on diesel Toyo stoves. And you combine the cost of fuel oil and the cost of electricity and the cost of water and the cost of flights to and from a community, which is most of those are also fueled by the cost of petroleum. Living out in a rural community just starts to get more expensive. So energy costs are definitely, I think, driving people, one of the many reasons that people are kind of migrating into urban Alaska.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we need to take a quick break here, but we'll hear more about energy solutions in rural Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Business Administration program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit. Today, we're talking about energy in rural Alaska. My guests are Dave Messier. He's Rural Energy Coordinator at Tanana Chiefs Conference. And by phone, we have Peter Larson. He's a research scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and author of a new report on this subject. And we want to hear from you. If you live in a small rural community, how much do you pay for electricity? Do you have ideas for more sustainable solutions? Call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. And you can email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. We do have one caller on the line that I'm going to go to now, Mark in Palmer. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for taking my call and for having a show on this really important subject. You know, I haven't seen the new report, but I was curious if your guests could either discuss or whether the report talks about training and workforce development options or recommendations for rural Alaska so that we have, you know, kind of trained people within any village that can do the kind of things we need to do as far as energy efficiency and clean energy solutions or integration of clean energy into diesel-powered systems. So basically, you know, what are the training and workforce development recommendations that Dave and Peter might have for us? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, the report does go into this subject in detail. Pete, do you want to take this first?
Sure. It's a great question, Mark. Thanks for bringing it up. Yeah, clearly one of the things we saw visiting a lot of these communities is we don't have local expertise. We have to bring a line worker in from Anchorage to help repair our system, or we have to send our employee or employees from our community all the way down to Seward to attend AvTech to learn about, you know, diesel mechanics. And so one of the ideas that we put forth in this paper is the idea of maybe we should think about decentralizing how we develop the workforce. Would it be possible to set it up in Alaska so you have many sort of training centers in the rural hubs? Now, it doesn't make, you know, a lot of sense to have individual training facilities in every rural community, of course. But the idea is places like Kotzebue, like Bethel, some of these communities that, you know, are real regional hubs, whether you could have, you know, a set of training facilities that cover sort of the soup to nuts or the end-to-end utility system, everything from bookkeeping to diesel mechanics to repairing lines. And so one of the ideas we put forth in this paper is, maybe we should think about ways of standing up training facilities in the regional hubs so that you don't always have to rely on Anchorage and you don't always have to send your employees off to Seward to take a class. And the idea is you can reduce expenses by moving the training facilities to these hubs, these rural hubs. And also what you do is you can create more of a community, a training community close by. It's a lot easier for you if you live in Kweefluk, to call up, you know, potential friends over in Bethel, which is not far away, and ask them questions about your system. And so that's one of the ideas we put forth on workforce development. And I think Dave has probably thought a lot about this issue as well for Interior Alaska.
Yeah, Dave, do you want to give your thoughts? You were talking about this a little bit earlier.
Definitely, yeah. Training, kind of operations and maintenance training, is one of the biggest impediments, I think, to running an efficient, well-oiled machine out in our communities. And I definitely agree with Peter's comments about trying to decentralize the trainings. And I'm sure there's also probably some legislators like cringing that are listening to this thinking, how in the world we pay for that? So, you know, in just a little tangential information, when I go out to a community and I talk to a rural diesel generator operator, you know, and try to talk them into going down to AvTech in Seward for 4 to 6 week long trainings, you know, their response is usually, well, who's going to watch my kid? Who's going to cut firewood for my family? You know, I'm needed here in the community. And usually they're one of the stronger members of the community, and they're kind of part of the glue that hold the community together. So It's definitely a challenge, you know, to get them down to Seward. And that's typically a lot of the response you get from regulators. Oh, well, there's opportunities down in Seward. Yes, there is. And there's a fantastic training facility down there. I've gone down there, toured the facility, talked to the instructors, amazing folks. They really care what they're doing and really care about educating folks that are going to be working out in rural Alaska. But one of the things we're actually kind of looking for some support at Tanana Chiefs Conference from entities like the Denali Commission is this idea of bringing some of the great work that the Alaska Energy Authority does through their diesel assistance program and centralize that a little bit more here in Fairbanks so that you might have somebody not based in Anchorage, but hopefully you'd have somebody based locally, very similar to what the RMW program, the Rural Maintenance Worker Program, does for rural water systems. And Tanana Chiefs Conference runs that, and I think very effectively. They have positions that are based at Tanana Chiefs Conference, so they're kind of culturally ingrained into the fabric of Tanana Chiefs Conference and understand the challenges of life in a rural community, which is something that oftentimes I think gets lost in translation when you're working with folks based in Anchorage or Juneau. So having people that are based locally that are literally only one flight away from whatever village they're trying to work with and people that have hopefully a longer term of stay and of work at that whatever entity is managing something like that. So maybe rather than sending an operator down to Seward for a 4 to 6 week class, you would have somebody based in Fairbanks that, I mean, just little things like, hey, how's the weather out there? Yeah, it's the same here. You know, and they can make regular trips out to some of these rural communities, get to know folks on a first name basis, and really be seen as a source of information, somebody that they're not as afraid to call. Because that's another thing that I see fairly often is you'll get a rural generator operator out in a community. They just received a new power plant from the state, and there's questions that they have. And maybe there's, for whatever reason, a little bit of a challenge calling the person that just came in to install that down in Anchorage. There's a little bit of separation. There's probably a little bit of pride involved. And whatever the reasons are, I think a lot of that gets kind of brushed away when you start to have more personal interactions, when you've been working with somebody regularly over, you know, the last 3, 4, or 5 years. And turnover is a huge issue. So, you know, training somebody, sending them down to Seward, it might be a different operator every 2 or 3 years. So having some sort of consistency based at a regional entity like Tanana Chiefs Conference, for example, I think is a huge benefit. And that's something that we're trying to move towards specifically with our 13 standalone utilities.
Okay. And Dan is on the line from Tenneke Springs. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm just checking in with, what the cost us to generate electricity here and on Chichagof Island, and small community, maybe 100 people at any given time during the summertime and less in the winter, but it cost us about 66 cents a kilowatt hour to generate the power with the diesel sets that we have now. And with power cost equalization, it takes it down to about 30 cents for the first 500. We are in the middle of a hydro project here that's probably about 50% complete, maybe less, I'm not sure. They've got the penstock in, and I think they're going out to bid for the powerhouse soon. I'm not real positive on that. I try to stay away from the electrical department as much as I can here, but mm-hmm. I just thought I'd put that 2 cents worth in of what it is here in our little community on Chichagof.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. And Pete, does that sound familiar?
That's a very familiar story, especially the costs of electricity. And just for perspective, I live in Montana now, and I pay about 10 cents a kilowatt hour for my electricity. And so it sounds like Dan is paying at least three times what I pay, and that's after the PCE program has, covered some of those expenses. So, yeah, this is a very real and serious issue for rural Alaska.
Yeah, the report also talks about economies of scale, and I thought that was interesting because that seems like a big challenge when you have these villages that are spread out. But what do you think are some of the opportunities there?
Yeah, it's a great question, and Dave used this term as well earlier, and I'll turn it over to him on comments on Interior Alaska, but I'll focus on maybe some examples of economies of scale that could be achieved in rural coastal Alaska. One of the ideas is that when we visited some communities,
you know, we heard that they were ordering or purchasing fuel and having fuel barged up and doing the negotiation between them and the fuel distributor by themselves. And then we'd visit other communities, and the other communities would say, well, actually, we talked to all of our neighbors and we put an order for fuel in together, a barge order together. And what happens when you do that is it makes a lot of sense. You actually reduce the cost for your community when you negotiate together with some of these fuel distributors and barges. And so one of the things we talked about and encouraged in this report is the idea of, you know, thinking about negotiating fuel purchases with, you know, neighbors or other utilities in your region, almost like a cooperative. Maybe you aren't operating your system like electricity cooperative, but at least you can negotiate your fuel purchases like a cooperative. And so that's an example of, you know, using your bargaining power to lower the cost, potentially lower the cost of diesel that's being barged into your community. And, you know, the economies of scale issue, I think, in interior Alaska is much more complicated because you don't have this negotiating power like you would if you were, you know, bringing in a big barge and, you know, having that barge delivered to a number of communities along a river.
Yeah, and Dave, did you want to add to that discussion?
Yeah, I can add to that. I guess I hear that suggestion tossed out at every meeting that I go to, and I just want to point out that, you know, as Peter just said, those are maybe simpler solutions for some communities than for others. In some small communities, you know, it's probably not unlike small-town rural America down in the lower 48. You can have a little bit, I don't want to call it animosity, but just kind of hesitation of combining with too many different entities because it adds levels of complexity. And some of the entities just aren't kind of as high performing as other entities. So if you get somebody like a city of 450 people and they want to try to combine with their order with a tribe of 40 people, that's another village down where, you know, maybe there's fewer folks in the office or there's just the communication isn't there, or maybe something happened in the past that kind of caused communication to break down. Those are all the sorts of challenges that that we're seeing when you talk about those bulk orders. And then sometimes the school district might not want to be involved and they have their own tankage. So I hear it tossed out as kind of a catch-all for fixes. I guess personally in my work kind of down in the trenches, I haven't seen it as a really easy to implement solution. I think that there's a lot of challenges associated with it, and it really comes down to the mechanics of who owns the tankage, which entities in a community work well together. And then how much are you really saving? Is it worth all of the extra hassle to save 10 cents a gallon on 30,000 gallons of fuel? Or is the bigger challenge really trying to tackle the line loss or the operations and maintenance question or what have you? So there's a lot of challenges. I think the bigger opportunities for economies of scale come into play when you're talking about things like line loss, things about kilowatt hour per gallon, efficiency of a diesel generator, having a lineman that goes out regularly, having a diesel generator a diesel generator technician go out regularly. I was just out in Anvik and Holy Cross last week, and I was kind of following accidentally a diesel tech from AVEC because those are both AVEC communities. You know, I was just chatting with him. I said, how often do you go out? And he's like, well, about, you know, once a year, twice a year, whenever is needed. And talking with the diesel generator operators in those two communities, they were pretty clear. They're like, yeah, he's a professional. He's gone to school. He can do some of the things that we can't that are a little bit over and above our skill set. So when I think of opportunities for economies of scale, I think more on the operations and maintenance side, tuning the generators, looking for opportunities to reduce line loss, et cetera. And then really quick, I wanted to make sure that I answered Mark's question because otherwise he'll call and give me a hard time. Just back to the need for training. There is definitely a need for training, and as we get into more complicated systems out in our rural communities, there's going to be even more of a need for training. But I definitely think it's important to recognize that, at least right now, and probably for the foreseeable future, diesel generators are kind of the backbone. That's what keeps the lights on in the clinic and the airport and the water plant and people's homes and schools, et cetera. So kind of designing the system to integrate really well with the diesel generator, the renewable system integrate really well with the diesel generators. Those are some of the challenges that we're kind of struggling with. And those are some of the challenges that, like, Alaska Center for Energy and Power here at the university, they're working really hard to fix the integration challenges and to study them and create solutions. But in terms of, it's easy to go in and install a 10 kW solar array on a small diesel generator that where the load is maybe, in a community is 50, 60 kW. But the effects of what that small solar array will have on the diesel generator, what effect is that going to have on the rate base? All those kind of tie-in questions that are really easy to gloss over, and I've definitely been guilty of glossing over them in the past, those are also opportunities. So when we talk about, workforce development and workforce training, those are definitely going to be key components of it, having people that can go in and install the solar, install the wind, but also components of that are going to be people that can go in and solve the integration challenges. You can read you can Google it and read articles about just mechanics of today, and how the car mechanic workforce is aging, and the younger generation isn't just going to need to be able to turn wrenches. They're going to need to be computer programmers too. And so it's that translates to rural diesel generators too. You really need the whole skill set.
Okay. And we have Noreen on the line from Nulato. Hello, Noreen.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I wanted to talk about, the PFD. Everybody uses the PFD to pay ahead till the next work season,
Yeah.
So we just get tired of being cut off in the middle of winter. Some people get tired of being cut off in the middle of winter, having to use a generator or something. And then, we tend to write to your representative, tell them not to touch your PFD because you don't know how fire season is going to work next year. And, you don't know if there's going to be jobs next year. AVAC, we used to bother them. Use the wind. Can we use the wind like those people, in other foreign countries to supply electricity? And now we're as fish techs, that went trading before, we're like, why don't they use the turbidity of the water to make electricity? This water will not stop running. I don't think the Yukon will just disappear overnight. So, why don't we use some of that turbidity to fuel our electricity, other than the wind on the coastal area?
Yeah,
and
Noreen.
Powers. There's all kinds of powers we can use, and us 200 villagers don't have to get mad. We don't get mad at the AVAC man anymore because AVAC uses digital now. If he shuts off your electricity, come springtime before fire season starts, it's really hard for rural people to live without electricity and and there's rarely any jobs around.
Yeah, Noreen, thanks for bringing up those points. I think they're really important. Do you, Peter or Dave, are you familiar with Nulato's system?
Yeah, this is Dave, I can take that one. Noreen, I completely agree with what you're saying regarding the PFD. I know a lot of folks in rural Alaska use that to, people, there's this conception that it's used for snow machines and new boat motors, and a lot of folks use it just to survive. And so I completely hear where you're coming with in that regard. The challenge with the wind and getting electricity from the water, and I've got some personal experience with water turbines. I was in charge for about a year of the project up in Ruby, where we tried to harness the power of the Yukon River and create electricity. And to be honest, that's why I love solar PV, because it's on land, it's easy. And I often tell folks, the organization that I was with at the time, they spent 3 years and many hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to get that small hydrokinetic turbine in Ruby to work. And I produced more electricity in the first month with a solar PV system that I installed in Nenana than we did in 3 years out in Ruby. And so, when you talk about technology, I think it's easy to see things on the internet and just assume there's an easy, simple way to integrate that into my rural Alaskan electric grid, and it's really pretty challenging, and we're technology is getting better every year and every day. Unfortunately, it's not as much driven by rural Alaskan communities because we're so small. It's driven mostly by the needs of larger cities and microgrids down in the lower 48, what they call microgrids, which are really just smaller systems within a larger grid. And so we're kind of technology takers in that regard. We've kind of got to wait for some of the technology to catch up. And there's a lot of great folks working hard to better integrate renewables into the small diesel electric grids. And we're taking information from other areas of the world because there are many billions of people, or many millions of people at least, that are relying on small diesel electric grids, microgrids. There's a big organization in Australia that's using solar PV diesel microgrids to offset diesel. And so we're working on all of those technologies, and I wish like heck we were getting there faster, but we definitely are, but it's never as fast as is needed to keep up with folks out in the communities. In regards to wind, unfortunately, most interior communities just don't have the wind resource. I get that question a lot from folks, and people see photos of the big wind turbines out in the YK Delta. They're saying, well, why can't we do that? It's windy here on the Yukon. And we've done a lot of wind studies all over the interior. There are precious few sites that actually have viable wind resource in interior Alaska. And that's another reason that we're trying to move more towards solar. And down in Caltech, AVEC just installed a few years ago, again with assistance from the Alaska Energy Authority, a 10 kW solar PV array. Up in Galena, they've probably got 30 to 40 kW worth of solar online. We're trying to do 150 kW array up in Hughes. So that it's always technology and progress is always slower than we like, but we're getting there. And I think that the actions of the state and the actions of the Department of Energy, specifically the Office of Indian Energy, have kind of gotten us there a lot faster over the last couple of years and over the last couple of decades. Unfortunately, it's not as simple as it might sound, and we still have a long way to go.
We need to take one last quick break, but we'll hear more about energy in rural Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit. Today we're talking about sustainable energy solutions in rural Alaska. My guests are Dave Messier from Tanana Chiefs Conference and Peter Larson, who's a research scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And Peter Larson is the author of the report that we're talking about that is, I should mention, on our website at alaskapublic.org if you want to check out the entire report. Lots of interesting information in there. And Pete, one thing you bring up in the report is this idea of using private capital to fund some new and more innovative systems in rural Alaska that could hopefully save on cost. Can you talk about that idea a little bit?
Yeah, and I think, this is the real challenge, is that getting private, rural Alaska was built in some sense on a lot of public money, funding from the state, from the federal government, and transitioning to more of a private model where private financiers are helping install higher efficiency diesel gensets and wind systems. This is the holy grail. It's a very, very difficult thing to try to get private financiers interested in rural Alaska. They will only be interested in places where they can turn a profit. Having said that, there may be ways that native corporations could get involved in rural Alaska more than they have in the past, and we already know they're obviously involved a lot in rural Alaska. But getting involved more in rural Alaska energy issues, I think, is an interesting angle that we started to explore in this paper. One example is what's called an ESCO. It's an energy services company. And ESCOs are companies, that traditional ESCOs are companies that will guarantee some level of savings. And the savings that the ESCO actually, you know, achieves by installing energy efficient equipment can be used to actually pay for, you know, the lease or the capital cost of installing the energy efficient equipment. This ESCO business model is growing in the lower 48 and in the rest of the world. The idea is, could we get native corporations interested in potentially forming an ESCO, a company that guarantees savings by installing energy efficient equipment in the communities that are, you know, near where the native corporation is centered? So these are ideas that we're very interested in exploring, mainly because we know there's not going to be access to state funding like there has been in the past. We know the budget situation in Alaska is pretty dire. We're also very uncertain about whether federal funding and how much federal funding will be available. And so we have to come up with outside of the box options to try to get some private investment in rural Alaska. And I can, if Dave and I were in the same room, I'm sure he would be rolling his eyes right now. But I can tell you this, that it's a very challenging issue to try to get private financiers involved in rural Alaska. But this idea of maybe getting native corporations involved in some sort of energy service company business might be a way of making some communities more energy efficient without using funds from the state or federal government.
So, Dave, we just have about a minute or so left here, but are you rolling your eyes?
Oh, I'm not rolling my eyes. I'm kind of, Pete's talking about what I would call maybe the Holy Grail. I wish it were, you know, it's a fantastic idea. It's what's proven and tried and true and works in most other places in the world. And one of the challenges of implementing a system like that in rural Alaska is, well, if you were to take that ESCO model and convert it to the diesel electric side of the equation, right, to talk about some sort of power production agreement, then you kind of get complicated by the power cost equalization program, which has the effect of, you know, it's kind of a perverse incentive where the power cost equalization rates are a little bit tied to the cost of diesel. So when you reduce the cost of diesel, you know, are you actually reducing people's electric bills, voters' electric bills, if you will? Because that's what really makes a meaningful difference. So the easy way to reduce electric costs is through energy efficiency. The other way is through kind of streamlining the power cost equalization system and hopefully removing some of those barriers. I would offer take a community and guarantee a private developer a set rate per kilowatt hour for 5 years. Throw away the power cost equalization and just take one community, give it a shot, see if we can get some private investment into our communities.
Okay, we will have to edit there. Thanks to my guests and to KUAC for engineering.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.